Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their travel trailer, which they have nicknamed Bessie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. It's the new year! Woohoo! Okay, so it's only a few days in, but I'm excited for a new year with new life and new civilizations nonetheless. I'm assuming I'm not alone on that one. But it's early on into the new year, so today we're going to talk about one of the earliest agricultural animals brought to this continent. One that had long been used by those that brought it here, and then adapted wholeheartedly by the peoples already here. It's an animal that has profoundly impacted the history of North America, no matter which way you look at it. I'm talking about Equus caballus, the horse. Horses are a thing of beauty to most of us, and most all of us have dreamt of owning or riding them since about the time we learned to walk. That said, I don't know how many of you out there have actually been on a horse. Maybe you do it every day. Maybe only once when you were a little kid at a birthday party. But no matter who you are, if you've ever made it up into the saddle, there's one thing you can relate to with regard to horseback riding. That's the dread that for some reason you'll end up on the ground during your ride and will have to figure out a way to get back up on the beast again. Seriously. Not usually the most graceful moment for anyone, no matter who you are. For those of us who prefer trail riding to the ring, it's not usually a trip of just a few yards, so for most people it's a very, very long walk back home on a hot day. For some of us, no matter how much you enjoy communing with nature on the back of an equine, there's a little bit of performance anxiety with the mount and dismount part, depending on the size of the beast in question and how many boulders and slopes in your riding locale at the time. I remember talking to Mary McConnell about her Cherokee and Choctaw ponies, and she kind of smiled as she said that one of her favorite things about her breed was that they were not huge horses, so they were great on endurance rides. And if you came out of the saddle somewhere, you didn't have to hunt around for a rock to get back up on your 17-hand horse. To some of you, that may not rank on your top 10 reasons you'd love a breed, but she does those steeplechase, foxhound, jump the hedge over the hill, and dale kind of rides. Hell for leather type thing. So when everyone else is flying around you and the dogs are barking like mad, the getting back on is pretty important. Again, you don't look like so much of an idiot doing that hopping stirrup thing. There's a lot to be said for a smaller horse that can still do most everything the big ones can do. They have less mass to sustain, so they eat less and drink less, and therefore cost less to maintain. You can fit more of them in less space in a trailer or a barn, so towing isn't quite such an undertaking. And there's a heck of a lot less horse to take a curry brush to at the end of the day. Which brings me to the animal we'd like to talk about today, the Galiceno. The Galiceno horse was a completely new breed to me, but it's both physically and historically interesting. This horse is another one of those agricultural animals that we can thank the Spaniards for, at least if any of the Spaniards were still alive that brought him over to the continent. According to my handy-dandy story guide, 96 Horse Breeds of North America, Hernan Cortez invaded Mexico in 1519, and he's said to have brought 17 horses from northwestern Spain over with him on the boat. In addition to regular transportation duties, these little equines were put to work by the conquistadors in the Mexican silver mines. Due to the complete lack of tractor supply stores at that time, fencing was kind of scarce, so they ran loose and they multiplied on their own as well. In true land race fashion, they adapted, evolved, and kind of did their own thing wherever they wanted to for centuries. If you remember your Lonesome Dove history, the official border between Mexico and the U.S. was a bit fluid for a while, so these horses can also take credit for influencing not only Indian ponies, but our Spanish Mustangs and the Florida Cracker horses as well. I do hope you go to our YouTube channel to see these little guys for yourself, as this is one of those animals that kind of takes you aback to see it in person. They're teeny, at least in the horse world. They're actually closer to the size of a pony, but there's no doubt when you look at them that they're built like a regular horse, just smaller. And when I say smaller, I mean smaller as in when you ride them, your left heel is going to be visible under the belly of the horse from the right side. Yeah, that small. 12 or 13 hands instead of 14 to 17. They're dainty, with a narrower chest and a smaller head, but they have a strong bone structure and strong feet and solid hooves. They're also known to have a great cow sense, which has brought them to the attention of people in the cattle universe from time to time as cow ponies. And that's something you can't always teach, from what I understand. These horses come in all colors, but no patterns like pinto or paint. Only solid colors are registrable. One of the things that Galicinos are known for is the ability to go all day, even carrying up to a 200-pound person over rough country, and they do it with style and grace. They're a gated breed and can cover the ground smoothly in their signature running walk, so you don't bounce around so much like a sack of grain as you go. They're pretty short-bodied, so they have a great turning radius, unlike most Mustangs. Yes, I just attempted to make a car joke. That's my one for the year. Galicinos are known to be great family horses because of their temperaments, but also because kids can be more self-sufficient equestrians if they can actually reach the pedals. I mean, the stirrups. There's no excuse for not being able to curry your horse either. Everything is within reach on these little guys. Galicinos are known to be good for trail riding, jumping, driving, dressage, and that short turning radius makes them great for barrel racing. These little horses can also stand the sun, heat, and humidity of Florida beautifully, which is where we met them. Although I have to say that we did this interview in January of 2017, so there was a little bit more chill than heat at that time. Believe it or not, Florida does get cold in the winter. Suwannee Horse Ranch is in an area called Live Oak, Florida, which is only about a half an hour from the northern border with Georgia. We had a delightfully educational day with scientists Rick and Pat Blaney and their ranch manager, Heidi Reinhardt. During our interview, you can probably hear the echo of our voices in the barn, the jangling of the halter, and the hay-munching sounds of our equine demonstration volunteer. The Blaneys are helping to preserve these incredibly rare horses for the future, and that's a really important thing. Because when I say incredibly rare, I mean that the estimates of how many registered animals are left in this entire breed is somewhere on the south side of 100. And that's the whole population, not the breeding population, by the way, which is much lower than that. The Blaneys own about 40 Galicinos, and they're scientists by training, so they're smart about the genetic soundness of their breeding program. You can do the math on how important this couple is in keeping this breed alive. And that's a really good thing. Galicinos just had their 500th anniversary on this continent, and as a breed, it would be a shame to see them disappear, wouldn't it? After all, the new is wonderful, but we don't want to permanently say goodbye to everything old, do we? As far as our animals go, that is. Happy New Year, and fresh beginnings to all.
Hi, I'm Rick Blaney, and we're at the Galicinos of Suwannee Ranch in Live Oak, Florida. And what we do here is breed Galicino horses, a rare Spanish horse descended from the horses that Cortez brought into Mexico almost 500 years ago. These horses are very, very unique, listed as critically endangered by the Livestock Conservancy. Our mission here is to breed, to increase in numbers, and promote and educate. We travel around the country to do just that. We've been to many, many states in the eastern half of the United States, from Texas, Kansas, on up to Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and all through the southeast. 37,000 miles the past year. Carrying a couple of horses where we then can show the public what these rare horses are and talk about the history of the horses coming into the Americas.
So why did you choose this location for your farm?
We chose this location for a number of reasons. Number one, I'm a Floridian. I worked in Central Florida for a number of years as a college professor and retired about 10 years ago. And this was a nice, rural, quiet area wanting to get away from the hustle and bustle of Central Florida. And the land was available and less expensive than anywhere else, so this is where we settled. We actually didn't expect to be raising horses at the beginning, but that quickly changed, mostly because of the effect that one of our good friends, Heidi Reinhardt, did for us. Said, hey, let's get a couple of horses. Well, a couple of horses turned into 4, 8, and now we have 57. 37 of them are Galachenos.
I had the same issue in my my family. I started with one thing, and then before you know it, we've got chickens, bees, and who knows what. That's kind of the nature of the thing.
We have a plaque on our wall that says, horses are like potato chips. You can't have just one, or two, or four. And so it goes. Our goal is not to raise horses to sell, but rather to increase the numbers of this rare breed. There's less than 100 of them left in the world, and that makes it indeed critically endangered. We're very fortunate to know that we've had DNA testing done on our herd, and they are diverse. We have good genetic diversity, which means we don't have a bottleneck situation. We have a good foundation for breeding to increase the numbers and not have genetic problems. In fact, we've had very little problems over the years. We've had 21 births on our ranch and 100% survival. All those babies are still here in at various levels of age. As you'll see, we have horses of all colors, ranging from white to pure black and everything in between. But they're all solid colors because that's what is characteristic of the Galachenyo breed. We don't have paints, we don't have Appaloosa. We have solid colors and roans and tremendous variety of colors. They're beautiful animals.
Okay, well, I'm Heidi Reinhardt. I'm the guilty party of getting this started with Galachenyos. And it wasn't really my fault, it was my grandfather's fault. In 1958, he was one of the people that brought Galachenyos from Mexico up into Idaho. And my mother called me up one day and said, can you please take my 2 Galachenyos? Road trip. So yes, absolutely. And that's what got us started there, a couple of mares. And we stopped in Texas and met the people there that had Galachenyos in the Galachenyo registry. And it just bloomed from there. Now this hungry hippo, this hungry horse, this is Angel. She is one of many representatives of Galachenyo. And what makes Galachenyos unique is starting with their ears. They have little pointy, kind of elfish little ears there, very delicate. Delicate in bone structure, including their legs. Thank you. Their height between 12 and 13.2 hands. And their feet, very, very strong, very rigid hooves. We don't have to shoe any of these horses. We've never had to shoe a Galachenyo. Their chest, very narrow in the chest, kind of a V shape. I get criticized sometimes at shows when I take them to shows saying, you know, you should have them pull in a cart so it'll fatten up that chest. Well, they do that, and this is just how they're built.
Tell us about the height of the horse and how that compares to the amount of weight that this horse can carry.
Interestingly enough, even though they are a small horse, she's on the larger side. She could carry a 200-pound man all day. And even though she looks delicate, she's very strong-boned. Even though they're not very thick, they're very strong and dense. These horses haul me around all day long, and will give lessons and use the same horse all day long, and they barely sweat.
Now, this horse doesn't seem to have a huge barrel on it, correct?
Correct. They have a very small barrel. It's very difficult to find tack for them because most people don't ride a horse this size, but they can outride most horses too. We put either Western or English saddles on them and they do just fine. We usually have to use a smaller girth than what's available in stores. We usually have to special order halters. This is a colt size halter and it has to be double adjustable because either this is too big or this is too narrow or too big.
Tell me now, some people might look at this and say, oh, that's a pony. You keep it for fun, but you don't really do anything with it. What uses do you put this horse to? Do you do showing? Do you do jumping? Do you do riding? How do you use this horse?
Okay, we use these horses for a variety of things. We use them for trail because they're very sure-footed and they're relatively brave and very curious. And I used to show them in English and Western in the same day. And I've walked away with more than one blue ribbon. We give lessons on them. They come in a variety of personalities and speeds. So we always have at least one Galassino that we can put a child or a grown person on top of. We do have a couple of them that can pull carts and do. They enjoy that because that's not really a lot of work. I mean, that's really easy. In Texas, they're used for cutting cattle. And they're not used for roping because they are a little too small for that. But they do have really good cow sense.
So in terms of the husbandry requirements of this horse, do they eat, drink a lot? Do they need extra grain?
During the summer, we have enough grass here that we don't supplement at all. We don't have to give them anything during the summer. During the winter months, if we have mares in foal, we'll supplement with some grain. And after the first freeze, when the grass dies, we'll throw out a couple bales of hay. And they do fantastic. They have nice, shiny coats. They get good winter coats. Fantastic conformation. We don't have to supplement much at all, just during the winter and just mares and foals and maybe the elderly.
Do they have a large heat tolerance, cold tolerance at all?
Well, they came out of Mexico from the Yucatan Peninsula. And when my grandfather, among others, brought them up from Mexico, they were distributed throughout the United States up into Idaho and British Columbia, and they did very well. Matter of fact, the two mares that we started with, we still have here on the property, came out of Idaho and had survived many winters very easily and came straight down here and do fantastic in the summer. It's not a problem.
So I know that in California, for instance, we have less and less water and that we have space requirements. So would a horse like this be appropriate for places that maybe the people that wanted to have a horse that they might maintain easier and yet might require less water and food?
Rick, you want to take that?
Sure. These horses are very easy keepers. The usual rule of thumb is 1 acre per horse. These can do much better than that because they really don't eat that much. And they don't have any food, special food requirements. The hay, the grain that we feed is ordinary grain. This is coastal hay. It's not special hay. And we find no need to supplement. We've had just tremendous good luck on health. And it's not by anything that we're doing. It's just that these horses are very, very adapted to a variety of conditions. They came out of they're descended from horses that came out of the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, where they're mountain horses. And these are less grazers and more like foragers. They will eat anything. They eat acorns. They eat
leaves
of various sorts, and any grass and weeds that might be around. So they're just really easy keepers. For a small farm, be ideal, because they just don't require a whole lot of upkeep. Water requirements, we simply have water troughs out there that they have free access to, but they're not requiring large amounts of water. Obviously, they will eat all that's in front of them and try to eat everything, but I can't emphasize it enough. They're just easy keepers. Health-wise, we've not had any problems. Foot-wise, very solid feet. All of ours run barefoot. And whether they're trail or just out in the pasture, not a problem. We've never had any hoof issues at all. Our farrier complements the horses a lot because of that. Never a problem. Hard hooves. He does complain a little bit because he has to bend down further, but otherwise they're just overall just easy keepers, healthy, and well adapted to any environment that you can find throughout the United States.
So it's going to sound like a personal question, but it's not really. Tell me about your vet bills as compared to other horse breed owners' vet bills.
I hear horror stories about vet bills, but for us, the only thing that we have is our annual Coggins blood test, and that's so that they can travel. Other than that, we vaccinate
and worm.
About the only other thing we use our vet for is when we have a gelding to take care of. I'd rather he do that than me.
Well, I'm Pat Blaney, and I kind of keep track of the breeding program and the pedigrees and lineages of the horses we have. We have worked with Gus Cothran at Texas A&M University, and we have sent samples of all our Galassino horses to him. And they can make a profile of the breed. So they now have a breed profile of what the DNA of Galassino horses is like. And if need be, if we have a horse that is questionable, that comes from some background we're not sure of, we can send in hair samples. All you need is hair samples. And it can be verified as a Galassino. In our herd, we have quite a few stallions, and that seems to be unusual. A lot of horse breeders only have one stallion, but we like to keep good variety. Our herd is quite heterozygous, means there's good gene variability, so there's not much chance of inbreeding. And it's my job to make sure when we breed that we don't breed close lines. And I also am interested in color genetics, so we sort of breed for color. It's nice to sometimes get a Palomino or a Dun or Cremello horse, and sometimes if you know the genetics, you can do selective breeding to come up with the color, well, the chance of a color you like. And of course, we're always concerned with the pedigree, the lineage, that we have a good variety of backgrounds for the mares and the stallions. And mares are just as important as the stallions are in the breeding.
So, okay, now I'd like to ask a couple specific questions. Why it's important to track every single animal and the lines that you have and not crossbreed?
If you crossbreed too closely, if you breed close relatives too closely, first of all, you'll end up more likely to have lookalikes. And it's nice to have a variety, especially of colors. And also, if there are any hidden recessive genes that could be deleterious, it could be harmful, then those might show up more often. And we've never seen that in the Galassinos. We've never had any genetic problem. But you just want to make sure you don't, come on one by mistake. So we try and keep the breathing, what's varied, I guess, and have different bloodlines. And also, when you have a rare breed, you don't want to lose a bloodline. You don't want to lose a line of a stallion that might have been, you know, come into the country in 1958. Keep that bloodline going. Same with the mares. Watch the mares' bloodline. You want to keep those bloodlines going, the old bloodlines. It's important when you're trying to save a rare breed.
Could you explain to, just if you were speaking to the average Joe and you had to explain to them what the difference between a breed and a line is, if you could do that, please.
I'll leave that to Rebecca.
A breed is a genetic entity, and it includes, it's like a population. You have many individuals in the population that share certain characteristics. That would be a breed. A line or strain, sometimes we hear about such and such strain that comes from a particular farm or a particular small area in the country, like a particular mountain range or a valley even, and they've inbred. So their genetic diversity is very narrow, and they're recognizable. That would be a strain. You can have groups of horses of different strains that are actually of the same breed. It's especially common in the Spanish Mustangs, where every location is designated as a different strain. And sometimes it's just by color, like the Sulphurs of Utah. And people recognize them because of where they come from and their unique traits. But a breed would be much broader than that. It would be, well, for example, on the East Coast, there's a lot of Spanish horses that have been isolated in different locations along the coast, from Virginia on down to Florida. And so we have our different banker horses, like the Corollas, and the Marsh Tackies, and the Florida Cracker horses. They all have Spanish origins, but they really are lumped together as a larger group, the Spanish colonial horse. And out west, as I said, a lot of the Mustangs, Spanish Mustangs, have come from different locations as strains. These are what we would call perhaps a land race breed of horse, because when they were brought out of the Iberian Peninsula, they came out of different herds as they captured them, brought them to Cuba, where they were bred, and then from Cuba into southern Mexico. In southern Mexico, they were free-range breeders. So we have natural selection taking place at that location. And the tremendous variety that was brought in, that very genetics is maintained as a breed. The Galisinos are unique from the other Spanish horses because of their genetic background, and much older. The other ones were brought in later in the 1500s. These come from the 1500 to 1530, thereabouts, out of Cuba. They were brought to Cuba right at 1500 and brought into southern Mexico, where they evolved under natural selection principles. These are the results. And because of the natural selection, it's what makes them hardy. It's what makes them able to survive in a variety of habitats, and I think it's what helps them to be easy keepers.
Keep the lines separate within a breed.
If it
is important.
I don't think, at least within the Galisinos, we have different genetic lines, meaning different lineages, but they are, it just maintains the genetic diversity within the population, within the breed. So to line breed and just have one line, you're reducing that genetic variation. We don't want that. We want that genetic variety because it enhances the viability of the breed. that was one of the things we were very concerned about, why we involved Gus Cawthron to do the DNA studies. We wanted to make sure that we had that genetic diversity. And when we first started out, more than 10 years ago, we were very careful in the selection of the horses that we brought to our ranch to make sure that they represented different groups, different strains, to maintain that heterozygosity, to maintain that genetic variation. And as a result, we've got a very strong herd that I think will show in the long run as far as survival of the breed. I know that there's been some geneticists who have been concerned about the fact that we have so few of the breed left in existence. But once they see the genetic diversity, they're relieved, and I think it says a lot for the survival. That's what we started out doing, and that's what we continue to do. And we are trying to help others to get started with what we're calling satellite herds, other people breeding at more than one location. Even though we have the genetic diversity, we have all of our eggs and sperm in one basket, so to speak. And if we have a natural disaster around here or disease come through, we don't want to wipe out the breed. We need more people elsewhere breeding these rare animals.
Now, actually, this brings up something that we recently discovered when we went to the USDA germplasm facility, that though you can have storage, a sperm bank, an egg storage, germplasm, the USDA only really does that for agriculture that's food production oriented. So how does that impact you, and how do you protect your animal in that manner?
We have talked about sperm storage, and it's a very expensive process long-term to maintain. And it's not looking good, honestly, that we will be able to do that for horses because, as you say, these are not food items. These are not produced for food. They are a heritage breed, and they certainly have usefulness on a farm. But to maintain the background of sperm banks, too expensive. So we have to rely on keeping a variety of stallions, and hope we can keep it going that way. I'm afraid, as far as heritage breeds, the reality is horses are a luxury. I wish it weren't quite that way, because we see long-term value in horses on small farms. They're still work animals, and they still can do the job, from pulling a plow on a small farm to pulling a wagon, etc. Their place in history has been taken over by, you know, trucks and so forth, and tractors. But there may be a time that they have to be used again on a small farm, especially small sustainable farms.
So if you had to make a pitch to the president and he was saying, tell me why I should spend government money to preserve genetic material from horses, or these horses specifically, as well as other animals, especially as it fits into biodiversity, the changing climate, the universe as we know it, systems theory, all of that that says the Earth is heading to a certain direction, why would you pitch him to put more money into saving genetic material of horses?
I would first hope that we would have a president who believes in science, and then discuss the scientific background necessary to do that. And I'm hoping at some time in the future that will be the case. And yes, we can talk about the requirement of genetic diversity for survival. And I think in commercial farming, that's becoming evident. And I'm hoping, of course, that will spread out to all of the endangered breeds.
So personally, if it's important to save horses and this species, personally, why would you say, yes, horses need to be around 500 years from now? Why?
Why should we keep horses around? It's really a work of love. Is there a absolute reason that we must save the horses when we have technology, when we have fuel-driven vehicles to take over the jobs? It's rough to try to convince outsiders who don't understand the value of the horse for its own sake. But there's also another aspect, and that's history. We are preserving history here. As we talk about horses coming into the New World by the Spanish, it's bringing history to life. We spend a lot of time going to different locations talking about, for example, the DeSoto expedition, there's the DeSoto Trail, Cortez, Ponce de Leon, all bringing horses onto the North American continent. And there's history. You bring a horse like this to a talk with a bunch of school kids, it's bringing history alive. And it's actually just wonderful for me to see how the kids come alive when they can come up and not just see, but touch, even get on their backs. That to me is worth it in itself.
Now there's a connection here, this economic viability of the breed in a way that people can use the animals in order to keep them going, whether they eat them or whether they use them for other reasons. And the history that you talk about, the first example that comes to mind is the marsh tackies with the swamp fox and how you used to use them to go into the swamps.
Yep.
And we understand that there's a breeder of marsh tackies that is using them because they're more effective than ATCs and other horses to go into the, they use them for hunting purposes.
For hog hunting in North South Carolina. Yes, we know him very well. And yeah, that's showing the value because other hunters that go into that area have difficulty getting around. Whereas the marsh tackie folks, they get in there, they hunt those hogs, and they're very successful.
Well, these being mountain horses also, we've heard from other people, they are very adept at traversing like canyons and narrow valleys and so on, rocky areas, much more so than the bigger quarter horses that they use around the cattle. You can use these Galacinos in the Texas hill country and canyon country, and they seem to get along a lot better, more sure footing, to round up those cattle in the more ridged and mountainous areas.
They make great trail horses.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the uses of this horse. So we were going with endurance right there. Were there anything that came to mind? Because you said you do use them for endurance, correct?
Yes, ma'am. We take them out on the trails. And we can go all day long with one of these horses, and they're relatively brave and naturally curious, so they actually enjoy going out on the trails. And I also show them in English, Hunter Jumper, Western. This here, Swanee Dynasty, is just a yearling. She's just a baby, so she might misbehave just a tiny bit. But she is one of our representatives of the Galacinos and some of the primitive traits that they carry.
So when you're on the trail, I look at the size of the feet, and you said they're sure-footed and they have small feet. How does that help a rider that might use them for trail riding?
They are very sure-footed, and you go out on a trail, you don't want something that's going to be clumsy. You want something that's going to be able to keep you and horse upright. We don't have to shoe them at all. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
And even though they look very dainty, they're very densely boned. So like the donkeys that take people on trails in the Grand Canyon, they're also small, very strong boned, very densely boned, and they carry tourists all day. Well, these have the same primitive traits as some of those donkeys. And it really is no difference, except that these are a horse.
So looking at the small size of this, I would think this is perfect for a child. Was that correct?
Right, and we have children ride them all the time. We've used them for therapy riding, and we've used them for beginner riders. We have some of them that take on the more advanced riders. They take on adults. this horse can, well, not this one, she's just a yearling, but the standard Galassino can take a 200-pound person all day long without breaking a sweat.
So you mentioned therapy. Tell us a little bit about the therapy that you do with these horses.
Well, we take them sometimes to this place, Camp Reed Conservancy, and children come in by the busloads and pet the horses, feed them carrots, get to go on their back. But one story that comes to mind is this young man that we met in Texas. His name was Ian, and his family were new to the Mother Earth News Fair, and they were neighboring to us. And Ian has severe muscular dystrophy, and is completely wheelchair bound, has a lot of physical problems. And I decided to ask the mother if she wouldn't mind putting Ian up on one of our Galassino mares. Mom on one side, sister on the other, and I walked that mare around, and Ian's head came up, a smile came to his face, and he just lit up. And I remember looking over and seeing the father taking video of this and crying, because it was just such a happy moment. They've actually written about that on our website, how that made them feel and how that made Ian feel. It was beautiful.
Now, aside from the obvious thing that says that there's a joy to sitting on a horse for a person that uses them for therapy rides, the practical reality is that there's not as far to fall if someone does come off a horse, which everybody does. If you ride horses, you're going to come off the horse at some point in time. Is there something nice for the parents of kids that come in for therapy rides because it's not such a large, imposing distance?
You're intimidating.
Well, actually, we have been getting a lot more elderly people coming to look at the horses because of their size, and they love horses, but these 16-hand-high horses are very intimidating when you get up there. It's a long ways off the ground. So we have people in their 60s and 70s coming and looking at these horses because of their height, their disposition. They're a little narrow in the girth. I mean, the barrel is quite narrow, and so it feels like you're riding a fence sometimes. So it does challenge your balance that way, but they have a very balanced gait, very smooth gaited, and people who are elderly really appreciate that. And as far as parents, having your child on a horse that's significantly shorter puts you a lot more at ease, because that child's not going to fall as far. It's still going to hurt when you land. But the child doesn't have to fall that far. And it's better proportion. And having a 2-3-year-old on a 16-hand-high horse, you kind of wonder how the kid can control it. But I think it looks better to have a child on this pony size. But they are considered a horse, not a pony. And that is because of their proportion of head to torso, to leg.
Now, you mentioned gait. If you could explain to the layperson what that means to have a smooth gaited horse.
That means when you're riding, you're not bebopping all over the place. The walk is very sure-footed and smooth, and you don't roll a whole lot in the saddle. The trot, you can sit in the trot and post in the trot. English riders particularly appreciate a nice, even rhythm post, and these horses got it. And when I take them into a canter, their canter is like sitting in a rocking chair, and it's just really nice and smooth and easy. And taking them into a full-blown run, well, I don't do that. I'm not brave enough, because these guys can go fast.
The kids do.
And they can turn on a dime.
Can you talk about the personality of the horse in general, the breed in general, and how it varies?
The breed in general, I've never met a Maine Galassino. You know, you hear about these horses that are just Spitfire mean, especially mares. I was just reading online about this person that said, I just completely dislike mayors because they're cranky all the time, angry and bitey. We don't have that here. We have mostly mayors on this property, and they are sweet and gentle. And if they're having a bad day, they'll pin their ears and walk away. And, you know, we all have a bad day. But I've never been lunged at or kicked or reared at or bitten. They don't do that. They actually have a kind nature.
We have five stallions living together on another part of our property. And the stallions get along fine. There's squealing going on sometimes, a little bit of show kicking and so on, but never any major problems with them. And you can walk out among those stallions, feed them carrots, pet them, and they're fine. They're very docile. I can't say docile, but they're not mean horses. And you can just go out and pet all the stallions, and they'll just be standing there wanting attention. And you can even feed them carrots without any problem. So they just have great personalities, just great temperaments.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please ask your friends to join us. Please also feel free to post any comments or questions to our social media sites. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Backyard Green Films. We love to bring you this podcast every week. We visit places all across the country and even a few places outside the U.S. We'd love to keep doing this as long as we can, but holy cow, gas is expensive. So we've started up a Patreon account. If you'd like to help be a part of the stories you hear, we'd love your support, feedback, and suggestions. If you'd like to make that financial support, please follow the Patreon links in our podcast intro for more information. Every little bit is another mile we can put on the road to bring you the conversations we hope you enjoy. We want to thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
We'd like to thank Rick and Pat Blaney and Heidi Reinhart for joining us today. If you'd like to find out more about the Galassinos and the Galassinos of Suwannee Horse Ranch, please visit their website at galassinos.org. You can also find them on Facebook. We would like to thank you for joining us on our adventures this past year. Please keep an eye out for our upcoming documentary, The Holstein Dilemma. We will post updates on how and where you can see it. Also, please check out our YouTube channel, Backyard Green Films, for more fun videos. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes from our travels. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2020.